you said a little bit about 20 faculty people were active, at least had graduate students,
yeah,
and so on. Did you start teaching introductory chemistry right away, or did that come later?
At Texas? Mm-hmm. No, I taught one or more sections of freshman chemistry and a course in colloid chemistry, predominantly for chemical engineers. It was required for chemical engineers. Mm-hmm. And I would have probably two of the freshman classes and the colloid class one semester, and two of the freshman classes and probably a section of physical chemistry in the other semester. That's where I started. The freshman classes would be two lecture hours and a recitation section. And at that time, oversight of the lab, because it was associated with that section. And the recitation section, I'd have one of the recitation sections, and then the others would be other faculty members and some of our senior teaching fellows. In the labs, I would have teaching assistants. I would say there'd be 200 to the class. That would mean there'd be about eight lab sections. Labs once a week, 4 hours. I think that's right. The colloid course, there were 40 people. I had a teaching assistant, and it had a lab. There were 3 lecture hours a week, and then maybe a 4-hour laboratory, just like a physical chemistry. It was a very fine course in the sense that the people that sometimes come up to me in airports and so forth, say, "Hey, I had your this class, that class, the other class." The ones that are most vigorous in their approval are the ones that took colloids. Now, these are older people because the colloid requirement was dropped from the chemical engineering curriculum probably in 1955. So for 10 years I gave it.
Was that standard in the chemical engineering curriculum to have a colloid course?
No.
Course, or was that unique to...
It was certainly not usual. Unique, I'm not sure. But it was based on two guys in chemical engineering, a fellow named Schock and a fellow named Noby. And these two people insisted that it be a requirement because they recognized that one of the things that their chemical engineers came up against in plant operations and in the development work that goes on around industrial plants are colloid-type materials. Well, it's just loaded with them. And that's the reason that these guys come up and say they're glad they took it, because they were prepared for the kind of things that they were going to see in their reactors. And, emulsion formation, emulsion breaking, suspension movement, things of that sort. They don't do it now. I mean, they stopped doing it in 1955 because it began to introduce this more quantitative modeling systems, and they had to move something to do it. So they moved something that was not in their own course. Both Schock and Noby died, and that was the end of it. That was the thing that went. But it was a good course, and when that went, I replaced it with a graduate course in surface and interfacial chemistry, which included some of that, and then another graduate course in electrochemistry, which I alternated. By the time that came into being, though, we were down to 2 classes a semester instead of 3. So I would give a freshman class and an advanced class. In fact, I gave a freshman class the whole time I was at Texas, every year, every semester. And I gave freshman classes at Rice for a while, until I had to be away too much. And I couldn't quite make it.
Well, I want to come back to that in our next session, but
yeah.
You had a very early paper on the equilibrium concept and way it was being taught or mm-hmm. suggestions about it. So that was 46, right after you got
there. Right after I got there.
So you obviously were involved in pedagogy and teaching yeah. introductory courses.
Well, we'll get to it later, but I believe that's as important a thing as I've done. As you said, we'll talk about it when I get to science policy.
Okay.
All right.
Fine. Your interest in corrosion carried over, obviously, right to the beginning when you started.
Yeah. My interest in corrosion was, sort of augmented by the work I did the Manhattan District Project.
So it started in the Coast Guard.
And I was brought in, as it turns out, because of deterioration materials problems. And the concern of what would happen in the K-25 plant if fluorine got loose. Not got loose, but got started on something. The real worry was that a workman would leave his overalls or his glove inside, and when we flushed it with fluorine. There was another worry, and one that was more real, I think. Not that guy might not leave his glove inside, but it was hard to predetermine what would happen with moisture if moisture got into the system. And to that end, it was my job in this wandering around the laboratories we were doing the work was to infect the minds of some people to carry out experiments, not to tell them, because the instruction was don't say nothing, but get them to do this. To infect them to the point they would do experiments that would involve the simultaneous injection of water vapor and fluorine under the conditions that were considered to be the problems, and to determine what the effect would be on a couple of things. See, there was not only the problem of an accidental burn, but these tubes, they must have been 15 feet long. They were just nickel powder pressed together, and they were porous. They had to be porous. They didn't have a whole lot of structural strength, but also you couldn't tolerate the growth of nickel fluoride into those pores, or you wouldn't get the fusion. And this process depended on U-235F6 and U-238F6 and U-239F6. And we wanted the U-235 to come through and be concentrated. You know, these were cascaded. There were great bundles of these tubes in a tank, and then the tanks were in cascades, and you'd run them downstream. The stuff inside would go one way and the stuff outside would go another way. But if it didn't get outside, it wouldn't do you much good. I don't know if you've ever seen that K-25 plant at Oak Ridge. But it's a huge place. I mean, it's big is big, but this is huge. And it's just a whole bunch of these things, one after another. And the concentration, I even forget the factor, so I can't tell to you. But the concentration is not great in each bundle of tubes. And if they didn't concentrate here, then there's no point in sending them to the next one. So there was a worry about what would happen if the nickel corroded. And say the high-grade fluoride had a bigger volume than the nickel that it displaced. Well, what would happen is you drop the porosity. So we had to get these experiments done and do them independently, and then I compared them so that the reproducibility was really pretty clean. I mean, Joe Blow here didn't know that Minnie Moe was doing the same thing. So So when we got results that, that were comparable, that we were pretty comfortable with. At any rate, that was the corrosion problem, you see. Corrosion is not just red iron oxide. It's a variety of things. When I got to Austin, I'd done that little bit of work at VPI and also at the Manhattan District Project. And I was interested in it. It was the easiest thing to set up. By that time, corrosion was sort of a little different. It had electrochemical aspects where electrolytes were involved. And the whole thing was buttressed by the fact that shortly after I got to Austin, I wish I could say specifically what sort of what part of the year, but sometime in that first year, not too far into that first year, I was visited by a fellow by the name of Tom Bacon, who was employed by the Lone Star Gas Company in Dallas. How he got to know about me, I have no idea. But he said that there was a field in east of Dallas, the Opelika field, in which they were having peculiar difficulties with a couple of wells. And he wondered if I would be willing to take a look at it. And that was my second consulting job. The first one was a suspension business. And I said yes without really knowing what was going on, but they took me out in the field, and what was happening is that they had two wells side by side. They had the same name, Tullis number one, Tullis number two, and they assumed that they were producing the same fluids. These were condensate wells, and one of them was corroding badly and the other one wasn't, and he wondered if I could help him find out what was going on. Well, I approached it in a fairly straightforward way. I got him to insert some steel coupons into the flow system and then took a look at those. And it was fairly clear to me that there were considerable differences in the two fluids. And when they went back and looked, they found they were producing from different horizons. So the fact they were sitting cheek by jowl had nothing to do with it. It was where the hole was. But they were impressed by the quick response. So then the question was, what about this one that was corroding? What could they do about it? And I established that the Tullis number two had a fluid in which there was material that acted as an inhibitor. Very natural inhibitor. The composition of liquids were fairly much the same. In other words, they both should have corroded, but one had something else in it. And there was a guy named Lochte on the faculty there, organic chemist, who knew a fair amount about petroleum composition. And we came to a conclusion that there were naphthenic acids in the one which was not corroding badly. And I suggested to them they take the flow of one and run it back up through the other. They wouldn't do that, but that would have done it for them. But I got interested in inhibitors. You know, I was impressed by the fact that yes, some millimolar amounts of materials could make that much difference. And my interfacial chemistry background, you know, explain why. You don't need a lot to cover a surface. Relatively, you don't need much. That got me interested in inhibitors as a research area, and that's where I got started on. So I was interested in inhibitors. I'd been interested in that oxygen lecture I told you earlier. That got me interested in passivity. So the two main thrusts that I had were how do inhibitors function, and what is this thing called passivity?
You also had The Corrosion Research Laboratory, did you start that?
Yeah.
How did that come about? Was that for funding purposes? To? I have a date here, 1948, so you were only there a short time.
Yeah. The first fellow that I had working with me, he came to get a graduate degree, had been employed at the International Chemical Company's magnesium plant just north of Austin. It was a war-induced plant. And why it was placed quite right there, I don't know, but they transported dolomite from West Texas to there, and the idea was to produce magnesium from that dolomite. International Chemicals designed it and operated it. And this guy worked for him. He was a BS chemist. He came down, that closed. See, this, I got there early 45, war was over late 45. This thing must have closed in the summer of 45. Never produced any magnesium, or not a couple thousand pounds of it. And he came down to the lab looking for somebody to work with. Call him Shock, Dorsey Shock. And he was a pragmatic type. He was not really, you know, an academic researcher. And he did do a master's program with me, but I told him, you know, he wasn't going to do the kind of research that a final oral committee would agree to, unless you want to go over to chemical engineering. But he didn't want to do that, and instead, I had a number of practical problems being offered to me. I got in to do it. He took space in my lab. But it became evident that there were going to be more things to do than were properly to be done in the academic building. And the magnesium plant had meanwhile been given to the university. And they were looking for things to do out there. And I said, why don't we set up a corrosion research lab? And we took over one of the change houses, rebuilt it as a lab, and Shock went out there to work on it. That's where that came from. We had a few grants and contracts and things of that sort. And he did a lot of practical work. It was known as the Off-Campus Research Center, or the sometimes called Off-Center Research Campus. It limped along. There was a lot of space, you know, 300 acres or so, and a lot of buildings, old change buildings and chemical buildings. Things of that sort. We put an accelerator out there while I was vice president, I guess. And it now is a very important part of the University of Texas complex. It is the Balcones Research Center, and it has, my guess is, 700,000 square feet of space, and a variety of laboratories and other kinds of things. So it has become a very important. That's where MCC is, as a matter of fact, the Microelectronics Computer Center. But it started from this little, almost wasted change room. By the way, that laboratory is still out there. It's not a corrosion research lab anymore. But that was the genesis of it, and that went on until Shock was picked up by Conoco. He went up to their research lab in Ponca City and became ultimately director of chemical research. And when he left, the corrosion research lab went.
I noticed, too, that you also had some early support by Research Corporation.
Yeah.
And then, I guess, ONR.
ONR started quite early, 1946, I guess it was. O&R was my main support system. In fact, the first papers came from ORI, Office of Research and Inventions. And for about 6 months I was under that, just by a letter agreement. And it converted to, then the Navy converted to Office of Naval Research. And that went on until from 46 to 68, without proposal. As I remember, it was every December I'd write him a letter of what we'd done, tying some reprints to it, and what we would do. They sent more money. And they kept doing it for 22 years. I thought that was pretty good. We got a lot of work done for them, though. One of the things they wanted was for me to get directly involved in their problems, and that I didn't think was a good idea. Not that they didn't have problems, or not that I might not be able to help them, but I thought that that's where I got the germ of this. I thought that the important thing was that in the process of carrying on this research, which could be useful to them as well as others, I had a pretty good stream of people coming through. I've had about 60 or 70 graduate degrees, 60 PhDs, and maybe 8 or 10 masters. And that was what was important to them. And we should come back to that on science policy. But, yeah, I think we better go.
Okay.
Is this a good place to stop?
Yeah, I think this is an excellent place to stop.